Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you so much, Madam President, for the very kind words of introduction. What I'm going to try and do over the next 30 minutes or so is explore the implications for what I'll call the fabric of the common law in a post-Brexit world where Ireland and Cyprus and to some extent Malta will be the only common law jurisdictions left in the EU, none of them particularly big countries and none of them with a particularly great influence, and to what extent perhaps a civil law influence will make a difference to the fabric of our law. I'm not talking here about the details, the technical details of particular regulations or directives or even decisions of the Court of Justice or Court of Human Rights, but rather to what extent the fabric of the common law will or might change. And will Ireland, say, in 20, 30, 40 years' time, remain an identifiably common law jurisdiction? And to some extent, does it even matter? And are there differences, really, when you drill down into them? Are there such huge differences between the common law and the civil law? Well, I think to start off, one can say that in the last 45 years or so of our membership of the Union, it hasn't changed identifiably or recognisably the civil law, common law distinction. You might ask, what is a common law jurisdiction? Fundamentally, it's one based on judge-made law with little statutory regulation of key areas of private law, although that's changed a lot in this jurisdiction and elsewhere, but it is a case law oriented system. Civil law obviously is code based, although there's differences between the various types of codes, between classically, say, the German civil code, the BGB from 1901, described as pandectus, which endeavours to really cover everything and set out very elaborate principles at a high level of abstraction and detail, especially for contract law. Or you have a simpler, more generalised model, such as the very much admired Swiss civil code of 1907. And typically, one has said that that's not precedent-oriented, civil law countries, but I think you would find that increasingly, and this may be one consequence of both the Court of Justice, the Court of Human Rights, and in the case of Germany, their own constitutional court, a case law has become far, far more important in those civil law jurisdictions. That's also true, France, Italy, and Spain, Portugal, than might have been the case certainly two generations ago. Now, there have been some inroads into the fabric of the common law by our membership of the Union. I'm going to give a few examples in a moment. The question I'm going to ask is, could there be fundamental changes in store after Brexit? Now, let's just take a look at some of the inroads to date into the fabric of the common law. One could give a few examples, such as the Brussels regulation system has not only harmonised to a very great extent our private international law, not only within the Union, but also without. It has led de facto to the abolition of a key principle in our private international law, that of forum non-convenience, and it's also led to the abolition of the anti-suit injunction. You see it in other instances of a distaste on the part of civilian lawyers for purely discretionary features which the common law typically gives to judges, whether that is within a common law system, perhaps stemming from equitable influence, but there is a distaste for that. The threat posed to the jury system by a number of cases before the European Court of Human Rights, which has passed for the moment, but it's still out there, the extent to which reasons have to be given for a particular decision by a jury. And then if you ask, what's the contribution on the other hand, I think you could say that there are few enough examples, perhaps, the other way, apart from the fact that the Court of Justice has created a huge base of case law, and la doctrine is as much important to civilian lawyers now as it is to the common law. But, I mean, above and beyond all of that, you have contributions from general principles of EU law which have seeped into our law and which we might have developed and were developing to some extent in any event, but they include doctrines of proportionality, concepts of abuse of rights, legitimate expectations, and the right to an effective remedy. But let me just take one of these examples and see how it was dealt with by the Court of Justice, and that's a case of commission in Ireland from 2010. And that concerned a challenge brought by the commission to a provision contained in Order 84A dealing with challenges to public procurement decisions. And by analogy with the Order 84 rules, there are obviously in public procurement cases there's tight time limits, 3-month time limit, but there was also an obligation on the challenger to act promptly. This is drawn from the then equivalent provision in Order 84. And the objection taken by the Commission was that this duty to act promptly was inconsistent with legal certainty, because somebody who was challenging a decision couldn't know exactly what the time period was. Did they have 3 months, or did they in fact have less? And I think the case does reflect a civilian attitude to these discretionary features of the common law, especially as far as the application of these discretionary features is concerned. And if, for those of you who got the paper, I quote liberally from Advocate General Cocotte, where she said that our defence before the court was that we're a common law system, and it says that in such, this is at page 3, page 4 of the paper, it says that in such a system, not only statutory provisions, but also decisions of the courts are determinative, and went on to say, well, look, we said, look, you should get legal advice about what the duty to act promptly means. And but she then said, if the position in national law derives from the interplay of statutory provisions and judge-made law, that must not take place at the expense of the clarity and precision of the provisions and rules concerned. That applies all the more where a directive is intended to confer rights on the individual. And she goes on to say that an unclear or complex legal position with regard to limitation periods could lead to the loss of rights in the present case, the loss of the right to review decisions taken by contracting authorities. So she went on to say, therefore, and the court agreed with her, that the duty to act promptly was inconsistent with the, as it were, the structure of the public procurement directives, that there should be a clear time period, and for us to graft on a sort of standard common law discretionary time period, which might or might not preclude somebody who would actually commence proceedings in 3 months, was inconsistent with that. And I suppose her opinion reflects a classical civilian attitude to the fact that rules have to be written down. I can recall a long time ago talking to a Dutch national who wasn't a lawyer, who was absolutely astonished to learn that the rules in relation to murder in this jurisdiction were not actually set down, or at least not set down fully in statute. And that, I think, was a rather astonishing piece of news for that individual. But that is very much the civilian mindset for both lawyers, obviously, and judges, but also non-lawyers alike, that they are used to the idea that key rules in society are set down in a text, that they can be found in a text and not in a judicial decision. Now, I suppose you could say, in relation to the Advocate General Cocotte's opinion in Commission in Ireland, well, there was a rule The rule was you had to act promptly, and you could say that that could only be elucidated by looking at judicial decisions. And the same, you might say, is true of many of the provisions of civil law. If you wanted to know, for example, how the duty to act in good faith, which is a key provision of both the Code Civil, the BGB, and the Swiss Civil Code, for instance, you'd have to take a look at a textbook, say a Swiss textbook on their code, to see how that general principle was being applied. But one way or another, I give the Commission in Ireland as an example of where, if like civilian values and a preference for legal certainty and for rules to be written down, in essence, trumped the common law method. Now, it's not a development, I think, that we should necessarily fear. But on the other hand, one of the great virtues of the common law is its flexibility, its pragmatism, the fact that it's fact-based, that it develops incrementally and generally respects party autonomy. And also, to echo the famous words of Garrett Fitzgerald, it works in practice. It mightn't work in theory, but it works in practice. Whereas you can admire the theory of the abstraction principle of in relation to contract law contained in the BGB, but that has caused huge difficulties in practice. I wanted to contrast, say, that approach from the Court of Justice with how our courts dealt with a sort of an analogous problem that had a European dimension, but which for various reasons actually never made it, so far as at least this point is concerned, to the Court of Justice. There are two cases, one called Olson from 2011 and another case called O'Connor. And this concerned the EAW, the European Arrest Warrant Framework Directive, which contains an obligation on member states to ensure that the accused is entitled to legal aid in accordance with national law. Now, the evidence in Olson and replicated in O'Connor was that we had a non-statutory scheme and that the Legal Aid Board automatically granted legal aid to accused persons in the same way as if it was a statutory scheme. I think, you might say there were some minor differences in the way it operated, but in substance, it was the same as if it was a statutory scheme. The only problem was it wasn't statutory. And was this a breach of the relevant framework decision? And if so, did this give rise to any rights on the part of the accused? Now, it's important to stress that both Olson and O'Connor were in fact legally represented. So you could say that their objection was highly theoretical. And that, I think, was the approach of the majority of the judges who dealt with this. Now, I think I have to digress slightly to say that it's important fully to appreciate the dimensions of this case with an irrelevant detail, which is that in 2015, if I've got it right, I think Bayern Munich beat Arsenal 10-2 over two matches. But just bear that irrelevant detail in mind for a moment, and I'll come. You'll see this all will be revealed in about a minute or two. Anyway, the fact that the argument was I'm entitled to legal aid in accordance with national law. National law means a law enacted by the Oireachtas, and there is no such law governing my case. Ergo, I'm entitled to some type of relief. Preferably stop me being extradited, but failing that, let me get something out of it. And that was rejected by a very elaborate judgment in the High Court by Mr. Justice Edwards. It was rejected 2-1 by the Court of Appeal and went to the Supreme Court, and a 7-judge court found unanimously in favour of the majority in the Court of Appeal. Now, there are no prizes for saying who my capacity is the most, the Guinness Book of Records for the most reversed judge, who the single dissentient was. But it was a matter of some discussion among my two law student children, and one of them at the dinner table after the the inevitable 7-0 crushing in the Supreme Court came to hand. And they pointed out, this is really bad, 1-0 in the High Court, 3-1 after the Court of Appeal, and then 10-1 after the Supreme Court. And as my son observed, it was even worse than Arsenal performed against Bayern Munich. But nevertheless, there is something to be said, if I may respectfully say so, for the position of the single dissentient. My dear daughter came to my aid and said that, so saving your presence, Mary, the Supreme Court were a disgrace. And that the case, she was going to write a case note saying, message from the Supreme Court, carry on discriminating. I don't know that she ever actually carried through that threat, but anyway, it was of some comfort to our father. Anyway, there is, all that personal detail aside, there is something, I think, to be said for the other side, which is that if you look at page 5, it said the extra statutory nature of the scheme is not illegal and it doesn't render it unlawful as a matter of domestic constitutional law. It's nevertheless not one provided in accordance with national law in the sense in which that term is used in Article 11.2 of the framework decision. And I have to say, maybe this case, in a sense, does illustrate the cleavage between the common law attitude and a civilian attitude, because the common law attitude was more or less, and you can understand it perfectly, what are you talking about? You haven't suffered any prejudice. You're getting an entitlement to legal aid. On the other hand, the civilian attitude is to say, well, wait a minute. This says in accordance with national law, and you haven't done it. You haven't complied, so it isn't written down. So I suspect that, if I may respectfully say so, if that case was ever to come before the Court of Justice, they, in an appropriate case, they would ultimately say that we haven't been complying with the framework decision precisely because it hasn't been written down. And that, I think, regardless of the merits and demerits of the argument, reflects as much a civilian mentality as anything else. Anyway, in the 5 or 10 minutes that I have available, I want to move beyond Bayern Munich and Arsenal to more deeper thoughts, which is, could all of this change after Brexit? And I want to give one important, I think, and practical example, which was the draft Common European Sales Law. And by way, that was something that was much discussed 2010, 2011, 2012. But it is interesting that President Macron, in a speech in the Sorbonne in, I think, September 2017, called for a unified civil law for both France and Germany. Now, to what extent that will ever happen, you know, is another day's work. But it shows what a lot of people are thinking, which is that large swathes of private law, particularly contract law, should be unified and harmonised in some substantive fashion. Now, that was essentially the proposal that the Commission had for their Common European Sales Law. And they had a proposal for what they described as an optional European contract law. You might say, optional for whom? But there was a discussion as to whether or not it was going to be a so-called Esperanto approach or a Franco-German approach. The Esperanto approach was, so to speak, look at the contract laws of the 28 member states, or 29 if you want to include Scots law, and sort of pick the best and have a mash of principles drawn from all of these member states. That's what the Commission said they were doing. The British government didn't really agree, and certainly the City of London didn't agree, because they said this isn't Esperanto at all. This is really drawn from both the French and German civil codes. And the if you look at the bottom of page 6, you'll see that 4 fundamental conflicts with the common law from the draft proposal. One was Article 1 was no damages for distress for non-compliance with the contract. Article 2, duty to act in good faith and in fair dealing. Article 69, pre-contractual statements could be incorporated into the terms of the contract. And Article 89, where imposed a duty on the parties to enter into negotiations where the performance of their obligations under the contract became excessively onerous. I would have liked to think, had it been enforced over the last 6 or 7 years, the types of arguments that would have been advanced in the in various mortgage suits and other contractual obligations over the last 6 or 7 years in this country. Anyway, the had this been this proposal gone ahead, it would have had very significant implications for the common law, because to take the Article 89, some of the Article 69 proposal would have resulted in the de facto abolition of the parole evidence rule. Article 89, the duty to negotiate where it becomes excessively onerous, has its origins in the German Civil Code's response to the hyperinflation of the 1920s. But as I say in the paper, it could play havoc with common law rules as to frustration and party autonomy in business-to-business transactions. Now, the duty to act in good faith reflected a standard key, perhaps the most fundamental principle of the various civil codes. Now, you could have, I think, an argument as to whether we do in fact recognise a duty of good faith, or whether there's a general duty of good faith in contract law. Now, in Flynn and Breccia in 2017, a majority, I think, of the Court of Appeal rejected the idea that there was such a general duty in of good faith. And I think it's a fair reading of my colleague, Ms. Justice Finlay Gagan's judgment, that it displays little sympathy for this continental cousin. I had the temerity to add a concurring judgment which left the door a little bit open, because I went on to say that I said if you look deeper into our law, you can find instances of specific doctrines and concepts which correspond to civilian concepts of good faith. The rule against self-induced frustration of a contract, equitable doctrines of unconscionability, fraud and a power, the principle that he who comes to equity must come with clean hands, and so on, are all in their own way potential examples of it. And I said that the fact that we hadn't recognised such a principle to date may over time be seen as simply reflecting the common law's preference for incremental step-by-step change to the case law, coupled with a distaste for reliance on overarching general principles, in this instance it's like an abstract duty of good faith, which are not deeply rooted in the continuous historical fabric of the case law, rather than an objection per se to the substance of such a principle. Now, a few months later, a slightly differently composed panel on the Court of Appeal had to deal with this in a somewhat different context, a case called Morrissey in the IBRC. Here the argument was Mr. Morrissey had a loan for, I think, over $30 million from the IBRC. There was admitted overcharging of interest in certain respects by the IBRC, and the issue was, had they, by reason of the fact it was said that they had acted, didn't act in good faith by overcharging him, deprived him of, did he mean that our hero was free at one go, so to speak? The fact that there was overcharging of interest, it debarred them from collecting their money. And again, we said that Flynn and Breccia was a sort of tacit recognition that specific doctrines developed in the common law, ranging from clean hands, estoppel, and so on, are but particular legal instances of legal principles that in civilian jurisdictions have been subsumed into the wider and overarching principle of good faith. And we went on to say, look, even if there is a general principle of good faith, it can't negate the substance of the contract. It operated in much the same way as equity leavening the common law, and it couldn't on that basis, if like, deprive people of their core contractual rights, which in this instance was to recover the money. And I Perhaps Morrissey is a single example, but it may indicate that the introduction of a general principle of good faith would not be quite as novel or as dangerous as some perhaps may fear. But it's still the proposal in Cecil, the Common European Sales Law, to have a general principle of good faith did raise the hackles of both the British government and the City of London. For instance, the bottom of page 8, they say that the British government said it was uncertain and unpredictable in its effect, given the width of the concept, little guidance as to how to apply. And then they said, despite the assertion of the principle of freedom of contract, Article 2, the obligation to act in good faith, undermines the contractual agreement of the parties, making reliance on what has been agreed and the remedies they have otherwise have unpredictable. So again, you can see that there was certainly an objection on the part of the British government to these principles, which would have been a sort of embryonic or potentially embryonic code civil for the EU. And the real question is, after Brexit, will this happen? And I'll just come to that in a moment, but there's one other thing just I want to say before I sit down, which was that there is also the question of the relationship between, if you like, Irish common law and the UK. And I just want to say one thing about that. I was just glancing through Christopher McCudden's very interesting paper, and he quotes from Byrne and McCutcheon in 2005 and 2011 as to the amount of UK case law, perhaps specifically English and Wales case law, cited in the Irish courts. And the latest figure for 2011, from memory, is about 28% of written judgments cite an English authority, and that the comparable figures for decisions of the Court of Justice were about 3%, and for the Court of Human Rights, something like 4.something%. I haven't done empirical research on this, but my own impression, strong impression, say from the last 4 years in the Court of Appeal, is that those figures, I think if they were done now, would be significantly lower so far as the English authority is concerned, and appreciably higher certainly as far as the case law of the Court of Justice is concerned. And I recall speaking with a number of Supreme Court judges and asking them the amount of EU case law that they had, and they put the figure at somewhere between 20 to 30%. A lot of it, of course, EAW and asylum related, but still the amount of Court of Justice case law, I think it would, I venture to think, in 2018, if you did an empirical study, would be far higher than perhaps was the case even 10 years ago. So coming back to the general question, what's going to be the potential impact on the common law in this jurisdiction after Brexit? Well, we've got to face facts. There will be the de facto isolation of Ireland and to some extent Cyprus and Malta as far as the common law is concerned. True, the Court of Justice is very concerned about this and is plain is reaching over backwards to ensure that the common law is properly represented in this diversity of legal traditions. But you can see it in a number of ways which perhaps only come clear to me in the last few months. I recall a few months after I was on the High Court, I was asked by somebody, what have you learned in your first few months in the High Court? And I said that the general estimate as to the number of sane people in the population is far too high. But if somebody asks me after a month in Luxembourg, what have I learned? It is that the number of cases which are decided without an oral hearing is far, far higher than I had realised. And the instinctive preference of many civil law judges is to decide a case on the papers without an oral hearing. So that's one thing I think that we have to be very conscious of in terms of the oral tradition of the common law. Do we place too much value on it? Should we accommodate ourselves more to the civil law? But that's certainly one thing that's happening. Another thing, which is a topic too great to deal with other than to mention it, is the question of the anonymisation of judgments, which reflects, again, a majority civil law approach rather than the common law approach. But, I mean, at a much wider and even deeper level, I mean, what are the implications for our core private law, which is in some ways the distinguishing feature of the common law tradition? The UK de facto blocked the Commission's proposals for the common European sales law. Will we and Cyprus and Malta be in a position to do that? I wonder. What will happen to EU contributions to common law, such as proportionality, duty to give reasons, legitimate expectations, etc., in the UK after Brexit? Now, I know that's something that Christopher is going to deal with. And if